friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Monday, March 29th, 2021. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And here is our first story. What we know, Iowa State crew club member is died. Another is missing after a rowing accident on Little Wall Lake. This story is written by Ben Yoder, Amber Muhammad, and Philip Jones, all of the Ames Tribune. Search crews resume the search for an Iowa State student still missing after the university's crew team, rowing team, was involved in an accident that killed one person. Five members of the Iowa State Crew Club were practicing at Little Wall Lake on Sunday morning when their boat capsized, according to a news release from the university. The body of one student was recovered by a dive team, while three students were rescued from the water. They were treated and released from Mary Greeley Medical Center, officials said. The search for the fifth student continued until nightfall on Sunday. Around 7:30 p.m., divers began to return to shore, and a Jewel fire truck and ambulance came to the scene. The sheriff's office said Sunday night that, out of respect for the students involved, they will not be named until the families can be properly notified. As of 9 o'clock in the evening on Sunday, Hamilton County Sheriff Doug Timmons said the search for the remaining student had been suspended and it would resume Monday morning. Timmons said they rescued the three students from the lake with the help of civilians. He said that people around the lake got in the water to help with the rescue. This could have been a lot worse than what it is or what it's going to be, he said. The accident happened on the south side of the lake, according to Roger Fritz, the former mayor of Roland, who lives on the west side of Little Wall Lake. At 9:30 in the morning, he said he saw Hamilton County Sheriff's deputies Ellsworth, Jewel, Stanhope, and the police by his home, and he was listening to the rescue effort. The Iowa State Crew Club is a recognized student organization. Members typically practice at 6 a.m. on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, at 6 p.m. on Mondays and Tuesdays, and Thursdays at 1 p.m. on Sunday at Little Wall Lake. Let's see, that's 6 a.m. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 6 p.m. on Mondays and Tuesdays, and Thursdays, and at 1 p.m. on Sunday at Little Wall Lake and at Lyde Recreation Center, according to the club's website. Practices are scheduled on the water on evenings and weekend mornings, according to the website. Little Wall Lake is located in Hamilton County, about 2 miles south of Jewel. It was formed as a result of glacial movements across the area. It is about 250 acres. The lake has a maximum depth of 13.2 feet, according to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. According to the My County Parks website, the lake reportedly went dry in 05-06 and again in 1936 and 1941. The wind was blowing about 20 to 25 miles per hour from the northwest when the crew team was on the lake, Timmons and Fritz said. Timmons said the lake was pretty rough. He said the reasons for the capsize were under investigation. Until 3 weeks ago, the lake was frozen over, Fritz said, and Ames Municipal Airport had a temperature of 37 degrees at 8:53 in the morning on Sunday, according to the National Weather Service. As of Monday morning, officials had not identified the students, pending notifications of family members and privacy concerns. In a news release on Sunday, Iowa State President Wendy Winterstein issued the following response. The Iowa State community is heartbroken to learn of this tragic accident at Little Wall Lake. At this time, we are focused on providing support to club members, their families, and their friends. We ask that everyone keep them in their thoughts during this very difficult time. On behalf of the university community, I want to thank the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office, Story County Sheriff's Office, their dive team, the Department of Natural Resources, the Iowa State University Police, the Jewel Fire and Rescue Team, the Gilbert Fire Team, Mary Greeley Medical Center, and community members for their response and their continued search efforts. United States Representative Randy Fenstra, whose district includes the scene of the accident, expressed condolences on Twitter Sunday night, saying that he was devastated to learn about this tragic accident at Little Wall Lake. Please join me, he said, in keeping these students and their families in your thoughts and prayers. United States Rowing Association Chief Executive Amanda Krause released a statement Monday morning saying, Our hearts go out to the families, team members, classmates, and the friends of the Iowa State rowing team during this very sad and tragic time, and we ask that everyone keep them in our thoughts. Our next story comes to us from Philip Sitter. COVID-19 test results before walking into work each morning. Iowa State University researchers are working on it. Getting COVID-19 test results in 20 minutes using affordable and accessible technology is the goal some Iowa State University researchers are working towards. And if successful, the technology and others like it could not only help contain the pandemic, but more quickly identify and help mitigate all sorts of diseases. COVID-19 is neither the first nor the likely last pandemic. Just since January, the World Health Organization has been monitoring individual cases or outbreaks of influenza variants in Brazil and Wisconsin, cholera in Tonga, MERS, another disease caused by coronavirus in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Guinea. If something like the rapid testing technology being developed at Iowa State University is viable and had been widely available in January of 2020 ahead of the current pandemic, a lot of people might have had a very different year than the one that they got. It really could have been a way to keep society running, Jonathan Clausen said. People possibly not needing to quarantine for a full 14 days because of being cleared sooner by a test. Hospitals being able to release patients sooner, passengers being tested immediately before they boarded airplanes, food processing workers and teachers being tested to avoid extended shutdowns at factories and schools. Clausen is an associate professor of mechanical engineering at Iowa State and the chief scientist of NanoSpy Incorporated, a biosensor startup based at Iowa State University's Research Park. He and Carmen Gnomes, a fellow associate professor of mechanical engineering, who is NanoSpy's chief research officer, are leading research at Iowa State using federally backed funds to develop graphene-based rapid saliva tests for COVID-19. Graphene is a carbon-based material known for its strength, electrical conductivity, flexibility, and biocompatibility, according to a news release from Iowa State. Clausen and Gnomes are using more than $900,000 in grants from the Department of Health and Human Services, the CDC, and the National Institutes of Health, not only to make working prototypes for rapid saliva tests, but also a methodology to mass manufacture the tests during common industrial printing using common industrial printing technologies. Saliva testing for COVID-19 is not new. The researchers at universities all over the country, including Columbia University, Johns Hopkins University, University of Illinois, Yale University, were all in the news in March related to their progress on developing quicker or otherwise improved saliva tests for the disease. Clausen and Gnomes are themselves working with researchers from Clemson University, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, Northwestern University, University of Hawaii at Manoa, and the University of Florida, in addition to other researchers and doctoral students at Iowa State. Clausen said, what would set ISU's graphene-based test apart from others is its 20-minute turnaround time for results, its ease of use, and its low cost, probably less than $10 per test. The hope is to have something that could, with just a small sample of saliva and people with a few minutes of training who do not necessarily have to be medical professionals, easily to be able to use the tests at home or at work. Clausen said, that could really open up new avenues of opportunities where you could reopen societies, perhaps in a food processing facility whose workers could maybe be tested before they even came in each morning. Graphene has a lot of surface area to increase its detection sensitivity for tests. A biorecognition agent on the sensor uses antibodies that bind to a protein on the surface of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 to identify it. Instead of using genetic material to identify the virus like PCR tests that analyze nasal swabs, Mutations to that protein on the coronavirus are what distinguishes some of the virus variants that have emerged around the world. Clausen was not sure if Iowa State University's test would be able to immediately detect all of those virus variants. We are hopeful that it will. If not, we need to make or purchase a different antibody for the different variants. And if that were the case, we could potentially have a variety of antibodies bound to our sensor surface that can detect multiple variants, or they could make variant-specific tests. He expected that the spread of variants will mean a need for COVID-19 testing for years to come, even once most people are vaccinated. Clausen added, "We're really confident that we can be able to make a sensitive sensor and that we can produce it. We have good fabrication protocols in line already to make these. The challenge will be, what detection limit do we really need to tell if someone is sick or is not contagious anymore? If he and Nones or other researchers are successful, it could be fundamentally changing society's ability to mitigate the threat of disease. If she knew everyone she worked with every day as an academic researcher had been tested for COVID-19 and cleared, Nome said, it gives you a big peace of mind. It would also mean in-person meetings and one-on-one discussions with students would be possible again. As things are, Nome said there are instructions to be 6 feet away from students while teaching, and she moves around so as not to be talking with someone for more than 15 minutes. Every surface that is touched in class also has to be sanitized. If everyone was cleared of infection at the beginning of the day, she would not need to worry about that all that much, and professors could really do the engaged teaching that we'd like to do in a university. Beyond COVID-19, Clausen said their sensor would be retrofitted to detect other viruses or do other kinds of rapid testing. He said the antibodies in the sensor that detect COVID-19 could be swapped out for antibodies that detect foodborne pathogens such as salmonella, listeria, or E. coli. We're looking at cancer diagnostics and other examples as well, but it's certainly laying the groundwork for a rapid test, he said. Someday, rapid testing could even be applied to look for the common cold. Whatever the disease is, Noam said, with rapid results, people could immediately begin mitigation strategies. And if the disease is contagious, people could be immediately more cautious about socializing. Our next story, Iowa reports another 46 coronavirus cases and no new deaths in Story County. The Iowa Department of Public Health on Monday was reporting an additional 46 confirmed cases and no new deaths in Story County. The latest data as of 10 o'clock on Monday compared to 10 a.m. Friday is as follows. Confirmed cases, 9,985, an increase of 36. Deaths, 46, an increase of 0. Total number of people tested in Story County, 150,554. Total number of persons recovered, 9,485. The statewide 14-day positivity rate is 4.6%. With the expansion of priority groups in Iowa, more people are eligible to get COVID-19 vaccinations, including all Iowans age 65 or older, an age demographic most vulnerable to serious COVID-19 illnesses and death. Let's see, vaccine doses administered in Story County, 43,184. Individuals receiving their first dose, 10,820. Individuals receiving a second dose, 16,043. And individuals receiving the single dose series of vaccine, 396. In Iowa, the data as of March 28, 5,725 deaths, 196 are currently hospitalized. There are 331,668 recovering and 12,146 active cases that are not hospitalized. And here on the website, I find an update to a story that I first read earlier in this broadcast. A second body recovered in Iowa State Crew Club rowing accident. This story is written by Isabel Rosario. Hamilton County authorities have found the body of a second Iowa State Crew Club member who went missing during an accident at Little Wall Lake on Sunday morning. Hamilton County Sheriff Douglas Timmons confirmed during a news conference on Monday morning. The search for the student continued until nightfall on Sunday around 7:30 in the evening. Divers began to return to shore at that time. As of 9 p.m. Sunday night, Hamilton County Sheriff Doug Timmons said the search for the remaining student had been suspended and would resume on Monday morning. Five members of the Iowa State Club were participating at Little Wall Lake on Sunday morning. They were practicing when their boat capsized, according to a university news release. Our next story comes to us from Daniel Gehr. Identifying the gaps. Participation in broadband survey could help Story County address internet issues. Story County residents and business owners can now participate in the Central Iowa Broadband Internet Survey. It will help the county address areas affected with unreliable broadband, particularly in rural areas. The survey is one of the first steps in the Central Iowa Broadband Internet Study, a multi-county effort, and it will be open until April 27th, according to a news release. Broadband issues gained heightened interest nationwide after the pandemic had more people working and learning from home. After federal and state funds were committed to the issue, Supervisor Linda Merkin told the Tribune in February, participation in the study will help Story County advocate for this funding. Having the data, having the study done, will help us make a case for what we need, Merkin said in February. The study will help local officials obtain the best possible picture of broadband availability, performance, reliability, and affordability, according to the release. By identifying the county's gaps, policymakers and providers will have opportunities to seek out avenues for additional funding. This will help open up more access to funding programs that are critical to attracting investment from private or public providers, Chamber Representative Nick Sorensen said. The survey will include an internet speed test, as well as collect direct feedback from residents and business owners. The Story County Board of Supervisors committed $20,000 in November to solve rural broadband issues, joining the multi-county effort, which includes Adair, Dallas, Guthrie, Jasper, Madison, Marion, Marshall, Polk, Poweshiek, and Warren counties. Also on the project are Alliant Energy, the Des Moines Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, the Pella Rural Electric Cooperative, and the Greater Des Moines Partnership. The survey is available at https://bit.ly/2NUZ d. And it includes separate surveys for households and businesses. There's a spot in this story to click for business survey and another spot to click for the household survey. Our next story comes to us from Isabel Rosario. A Nevada man is arrested after a two-week-old baby is found with bruises and air building up in the baby's lungs. Editor's note, this story begins with an editor's note. Christopher Lee Roberts Morin pled guilty to child endangerment on February 9th of 2021. Moran was sentenced to an undetermined term not to exceed 5 years. End editor's note. A Nevada man is charged with child endangerment causing serious injury after a two-week-old child was hospitalized last week. Christopher Lee Roberts Moran, age 26, is alleged to be responsible for causing injuries to the child who was under Moran's direct care. Nevada police were dispatched to the Story County Medical Center on October 20th after the child was brought into the emergency room for breathing difficulty. Medical staff found bruises on the child's chin, left ear, and both sides of the child's head, according to the criminal complaint. Pockets of air on the child's lungs and around the child's heart are consistent with oxygen deprivation. A pediatric emergency team from Blank Children's Hospital intubated and transported the child to Des Moines, where the child was put on a ventilator at the pediatric intensive care unit. Nevada police called the Iowa Division Criminal Investigation to assist. Nevada Public Safety Director Ricardo Martinez II said on Thursday. Detectives interviewed people living at the child's Nevada residence, where Martinez said the crime likely occurred. Martinez says he does not know the child's present condition. Moran initially told law enforcement that the child fell or rolled over and hit their head on the floor. According to the criminal complaint, Moran said he may have caused the injuries when he dropped the child into a bouncy chair and squeezed the child's face with his hands. Later, Moran admitted to placing the infant against his body to the point the infant was not able to breathe for 20 seconds, the criminal complaint says. Moran was arrested Wednesday morning. He was transported to Story County Jail, and he is being held there without bond, and the investigation is continuing. Here's a little short history item from the Ames Tribune. It's titled 80 Years of O'Neill. 80 years ago on this day in Ames history, it's actually Sunday, March 28, 1941, O'Neill Park was presented to the Ames Park Commission. Brothers Henry and Clem O'Neill had plans to build a new dairy building on that land between South Oak and South Maple Avenues. The city agreed to rezone when the brothers offered half of the land for a city park. The dairy plant was never built, though. World War II and the loss of two of Henry's three sons likely slowed and inevitably stopped the construction of the plant, the milk plant. O'Neill Drive in the northern part of Ames was named after Henry's sons, Charles and James. And a story from the Associated Press, a beloved children's author dies. Beverly Cleary, the celebrated children's author whose memories of her Oregon childhood were shared with millions through the likes of Ramona and Beezus Quimby and Henry Huggins, has passed away. She was 104 years old. Cleary's publisher, HarperCollins, announced Friday that the author passed away Thursday at Northern California, where she had lived since the 1960s. No cause of death was given. Trained as a librarian, Cleary did not start writing books until her early 30s, when she wrote Henry Huggins, which was published in 1950. Children worldwide came to love the adventures of Huggins and neighbors Ellen Tebbets and Chris Spofford, Beatrice Beezus, Quimby, and her younger sister Ramona. They inhabit a down-home, wholesome setting on Klicktat Street, a real street in Portland, Oregon, the city where Cleary spent much of her youth. Among the Henry titles were Henry and Ribsy, Henry and the Paper Route, Henry and Beezus, Ramona, and perhaps her best-known character, made her debut in Henry Huggins with only a brief mention. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. John L. Jack Cleesby, age 93, passed away on Wednesday, March 24th at North Crest Health Center in Ames. Friends may call from 5 p.m. until 7 p.m. on Friday, April 9th at the Adams Funeral Home. A private family memorial service will be held at 11 o'clock in the morning at First Baptist Church in Ames. The service will be live streamed, and a link will be available on the tribute wall of Jack's obituary on the Adams Funeral Home website. Burial will be held in the Ames Municipal Cemetery. John L. Cleesby was born March 1st, 1928, in Madison, Wisconsin, to Clarence Allen and Othelia Amanda Swanson Cleesby. He graduated from East High School in Madison, and he served in the United States Navy in 1945 and 1946. He received his Bachelor of Science and Master of Science degrees in Civil Engineering from the University of Wisconsin in 1950 and 1951, and his PhD degree from Iowa State University in Sanitary Engineering in 1960. He was on the Civil Engineering faculty at Iowa State University from 1954 until his retirement in 1994. He served as instructor through professor, and in 1983 he was appointed Anson Marston Distinguished Professor in Engineering. He was major professor for 49 MS and 13 PhD graduates. He was granted the Outstanding Teacher Award from the university in 1977 and the David R. Boylan Emmett Faculty Award for Research in 1989. He served as visiting professor of civil engineering at the University College London for 1 year in 1975-76. He was active in several professional organizations, and he served as division officer in the American Water Works Association, the AWWA, and the American Society of Civil Engineers, or the ASCE. Also, he served as president of the Iowa sections of those two organizations. He received 9 national awards from AWWA and ASCE for his research publications. He was elected honorary member of AWWA in 1986 and granted the Abel Woolman Award from AWWA in 1997. He was elected to the National Academy of Engineering in 1983. He taught short courses on modern drinking water treatment practices in 9 countries in Latin America, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East for the World Health Organization, the Pan American Health Organization, and for specific institutions. He consulted on water treatment problems in this country and internationally. He married Donna Jean Haug on September 2, 1950. Over the years, they have enjoyed extensive domestic and international travel together, family events, sailing, dancing, and winter sports in earlier years. Since retirement, Jack resumed his golf hobby. He developed an interest in computers, an active member of Kiwanis Club, as well as weekly ping pong games with his lifelong friends residing at Northcrest. He was a member of the First Baptist Church in Ames. He sang in the choir. He served multiple terms on the trustees, 2 terms as treasurer totaling 16 years, and on other committees and boards. He was involved in community service, serving 9 years on the board of directors of Youth and Shoulder Services, and as a property manager for Story County Housing in its early years. He and Donna have provided long-time assistance to a Laotian refugee family sponsored by the church. Survivors include his son, Richard and Catherine Cleesby, daughter, Lynn and Brian Miller, one brother, James, 2 sisters, Rita and Patricia, also grandsons, Sean and Christina Miller, Craig and Troy Miller, Jeffrey and Tanya Fitch, Christopher and Stephanie Fitch, granddaughters, Nicole and Nathan Mayer, and Danielle and Joshua Preeb. 15 great-grandchildren and 6 great-great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his loving wife, Donna, who passed in 2019, his parents, Clarence and Othelia Cleesby, his daughter, Teresa Osholtree, a sister-in-law, Charlene Cleesby, and 2 brothers-in-law, James Honold and Charles Cook. Jack was a loving and devoted husband to his wife, Donna. He welcomed and loved all people. He was a generous person, giving of himself in all ways. He was very proud of his family. His Christian faith was also very important to him, and it reflected in how he lived his life and how he respected and treated his family, his students, faculty members, and friends. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of the Adams Funeral Home, and online condolences may be left for Jack's family at adamssoderstrom.com. In lieu of flowers, memorials can be made to Youth and Shelter Services in Ames or the First Baptist Church in Ames. Our next obituary, Miranda S. Squires, age 42, of Boone, passed away March 24th. Ames Monument and Cremation Center is handling arrangements. Our next obituary, Darrell W. Burby, Jr., of Ames, 76 years old, passed away March 25th. Ames Monument and Cremation Center is handling arrangements. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press, the Dateline Boulder, Colorado. The suspect in the Colorado supermarket shootings bought a firearm at a local gun store after passing a background check, and he also had a second weapon with him that he did not use in the attack that killed 10 people this week. Authorities and the gun store owner said on Friday. Investigators are working to determine the motive for the shooting, but they do not know yet why the suspect chose the store in Boulder or what led him to carry out the rampage, according to Police Chief Harold. Like the rest of the community, we want to know why that King Shoppers, Why Boulder, Why Monday, Harold said. Boulder County District Attorney Michael Daugherty said the quick response by officers kept others inside the store out of danger, but he declined to say how many people were there. Investigators have an idea of how many shots were fired in the gun battle between officers and the suspect, but they are not revealing it yet, Daugherty said. More charges will be added to the current 10 counts of murder filed against the suspect, Ahmad El-Alawi Alisa. He is 21 years old. They would stem from shots fired at officers, Daugherty said. John Mark Eagleton, owner of Eagle's Nest Armory in the Denver suburb of Arvada, said his store was cooperating with authorities. The suspect passed a background check by the Colorado Bureau of Investigation before buying the gun, Eagleton said. Another story from the Associated Press. The dateline is Cairo, Egypt. Two trains crashed on Friday in southern Egypt, killing at least 32 persons and injuring 165, according to authorities, in the latest of a series of deadly accidents in the country's troubled railroad system. Someone apparently activated the emergency brakes on a passenger train, and it was rear-ended by another train, causing two cars to derail and flip on their side. That according to Egypt's railway authority. The passenger train was headed to the Mediterranean port of Alexandria, which is north of Cairo, the statement said. Video showed twisted piles of metal with passengers covered with dust trapped inside, some bleeding and others unconscious. Bystanders removed the dead and laid them on the ground nearby. More than 100 ambulances were sent to the scene in the province of Shouag, which is about 270 miles south of Cairo. Health Minister Hala Zayed said, and the injured were taken to four hospitals. Injuries included broken bones, cuts, and bruises. Airplanes carrying 52 doctors, mostly surgeons, were sent to Shouag. Next, we have a story from the Associated Press. The dateline is Roma, Texas. The title, Texas Town is the Migrant Epicenter. Children as young as seven have been arriving alone. As darkness sets on the Rio Grande, United States Border Patrol agents hear pumps inflating rafts across the river in Mexico. It is about to get busy. Within an hour, about 100 people have been dropped off in the United States, including many families with toddlers and children as young as seven traveling alone. All wear numbered yellow plastic wristbands that look like they could be used to get into a concert or an amusement park, and everyone rips them off and tosses them on the ground after setting foot in the United States. Large black letters on the waistbands or wristbands read Integras, or in English, deliveries. Apparently a mechanism for smugglers to keep track of immigrants they are ferrying across the river that separates Texas and Mexico. Roma, a town of 10,000 people with historic buildings and boarded up storefronts in Texas, Rio Grande Valley, is the latest epicenter of illegal crossings, where growing numbers of families and children are entering the United States to seek asylum. United States authorities reported more than 100,000 encounters on the southern border in February, the highest since a four-month streak in 2019. Encounters have averaged about 5,000 people every day throughout March, which would be about a 50% increase over February, if those figures hold for the month. According to a senior Border Patrol official who spoke to reporters on Friday on the condition of anonymity, more than 16,000 unaccompanied children were in government custody as of Thursday, including about 5,000 in substandard Customs and Border Protection facilities. President Biden, who many immigrants see as more welcoming than his predecessor, pushed back on suggestions that his administration's immigration policies are responsible for the rising numbers. Biden said Thursday that the government will take steps to more quickly move hundreds of migrant children and teenagers out of the cramped detention facilities. On the Rio Grande River, a smuggler balked when a U.S. agent asks him to land downriver on a rare patch of sand, complaining that another agent punctured his raft days earlier. The agent reassures him and negotiates a landing away from gnarly branches. Children aboard, another smuggler shouts to authorities. Children aboard, another smuggler shouts to authorities. As the rafts approach shore Wednesday night, smugglers jumped into the shallow water, lifted the children, and took the hands of adults lined up single file to get off the rafts. The migrants walked or were carried a few steps, and the smuggler turned around for the next passenger without touching dry land. A 7-year-old girl named Kaylee fought back tears as she bemoaned leaving her phone in the raft. A smuggler tells her she did not, and she appears to shrug it off. Her mother's United States phone number is written in black marker on the arm over her shirt, or the arm of her shirt. U.S. agents escort groups of migrants about half a mile over dirt roads to a dead-end street on the edge of Roma, where other agents at a white folding table examine identification documents. They take names and destinations, and they answer questions. Children traveling alone are separated from families, and people put their valuables in a plastic bag. From there, they get into buses, vans, and SUVs. Unaccompanied children are supposed to be held by CBP no more than 72 hours, but they are often held longer because U.S. Health and Human Services lacks the space. Health and Human Services is housing children at the Dallas Convention Center, and it said it will open emergency facilities in venues or military bases in San Antonio, Texas, El Paso, Texas, and San Diego, California, as well as elsewhere. The Biden administration expels nearly all single adults without an opportunity to seek asylum under a public health order issued at the beginning of the pandemic. They are about 2,200 of the roughly 5,000 people encountered every day in March, according to the Border Patrol. About 450 to 500 are unaccompanied minors, and the rest are families who are being allowed to stay, at least temporarily, if the children are under 7 years of age and if they cannot immediately be returned to Mexico, which has reduced the number of families it will accept into shelters in the state of Tamaulipas, south of the Rio Grande Valley, the official said. It is not unusual to see increases in migrants crossing the border in the spring and the summer, and the Border Patrol has faced similar situations in the past. However, the official said the large numbers of teens and children and their space limitations resulting from the pandemic have made this year especially difficult. The reason this is much different this year than it has been in previous years is, number one, we are faced with some unique challenges, he said. In 2019, Central American migrants favored crossing in a nearby area in the Rio Grande Valley, which is the busiest corridor for illegal crossings. But a wall built during Donald Trump's presidency has pushed them closer to Roma, where the channel is relatively narrow, but the current is brisk. A 17-year-old from El Salvador said he left home recently because he felt threatened by gangs and believes Biden is sympathetic to migrants. Asked how he knew of Biden's positions, he said, "People talk." Mayor Cruz, age 29, said Biden's policies had nothing to do with his decision to leave San Pedro Sula, Honduras, about 2 months ago, but he heard that families with young children were being allowed to remain in the United States. That was not Mayor Cruz, it was Menor, first name Menor, last name Cruz. Cruz said he was happy to be in the United States after a treacherous journey through Mexico, during which someone tried to kidnap his daughter. He left Honduras with his wife and his children, ages 7 and 2, because he lost his job in a condiment factory when the pandemic struck, and his home was destroyed by a tropical storm in November. He was able to raise enough money for the journey through family in the United States. It is difficult to begin from zero in Honduras with what you earn here, what you earn there, he said. At the river, a full set in. At the river, a lull set in after the initial rush. CBP reported that it took 681 unaccompanied children into custody on Wednesday, a total that excludes Mexicans, who are typically returned immediately. Our next story comes to us from Beijing, China, the Associated Press. China hits the United States and Canada on rights. China on Saturday announced new sanctions against the United States and Canadian officials in a growing political and economic feud over its policies in the traditionally Muslim region of Xinjiang. A statement from the Foreign Ministry said the head of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, Gail Manchin, would be barred from visiting mainland China, Hong Kong, or Macau, as well as having any dealings with Chinese financial entities. The commission's vice chairperson, Tony Perkins, was also included on the sanctioned list, along with Canadian Member of Parliament Michael Chong and the body's Subcommittee on International Human Rights. China has strongly rejected accusations of human rights abuses in Xinjiang province and has launched calls for boycotts and other punishments against foreign firms, including retailers H&M and Nike, along with sanctions against foreign government officials and activists whom it says are spreading false information about its policies towards Uyghurs and members of other Muslim minority groups in Xinjiang. They must stop political manipulation on Xinjiang-related issues, stop interfering in China's internal affairs in any form, and refrain from going further down the wrong path. Otherwise, they will get their fingers burnt, the official ministry statement said. Our next story comes to us from Geneva, Switzerland, the Associated Press. The WHO looks to the United States as vaccine supplies lag. A leader of the United Nations-backed program to ship COVID-19 vaccines to needy people in low- and middle-income countries has expressed disappointment about supply delays from a key Indian manufacturer, but he says he hopes the United States can begin sharing shots soon. Dr. Seth Berkley, the chief executive of the Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, said Friday that doses for healthcare workers and other high-risk groups through the COVAX program will be set back weeks. He was elaborating on an announcement a day earlier from Gavi and its partners that as many as 90 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine made by the Serum Institute of India would be delayed through the end of April as India's government grapples with a spike in infections. The United States is among some wealthy countries that have snatched up more doses than needed by its population. The Biden administration has announced plans to share doses. Berkley expressed hope that some doses obtained by the United States will be made available to help with some of this short-term issue in terms of supply. Our next story comes to us from, Virginia Beach, Virginia, and the Associated Press. Overnight shootings along the beachfront in Virginia Beach left 2 people dead and 8 wounded in a scene described by authorities on Saturday as very chaotic. In a statement, the Virginia Beach Police Department said the first shooting occurred shortly after 11 o'clock at night Friday when police who were patrolling the area heard gunfire. Several minutes after police responded, police officers heard additional gunshots nearby and found a woman who died of her injuries. Investigators believe the woman's fatal shooting was not related to the initial shooting. While officers were investigating the shootings, shots were fired nearby, according to Police Chief Paul Newdugate. An officer confronted a male suspect and fatally shot him. The officer has been placed on administrative leave. He has been with the department for 5 years and is assigned to its Special Operations Division. We have a very chaotic incident, a very chaotic night, Newdugate said. In a news release Saturday, police said investigators believe the first shooting stemmed from some type of conflict and a fight involving a group of people. A total of 10 people were wounded by gunfire, including the 2 who died, according to police. In addition, an officer sustained minor injuries after being struck by a vehicle, according to Newdugate. The injured officer has been released from a hospital, according to police. And we have some of your letters to the editor. The first one is written by Terry Lohman. He lives in Ames. I've been following the flap about celebrating Black Lives Matter in Ames schools, and I think it's nonsense. The complaint, a state representative from Oskaloosa, where the students are 95% white, appears to be clueless. Bravo for Ames schools for making the effort for inclusion and equity. If we want successful kids, we need them to feel comfortable in any community, whatever the demographics. Our next story comes to us from Mark Clipsham. He lives in Ames. I stopped answering my phone last week. I just checked messages at the end of the day. How did these spammers and scammers get the legal right to use my equipment service and my time to bother me? It used to be just harassment. That is what it is when you ask someone repeatedly to stop bothering you and they keep doing it. They are now repeatedly, chronically violating my rights to pursue happiness and be secure in my own home and my person. By virtue of the method alone, I would never use the services they have been offering me every day for the last 8 or 10 years. If they've really been monitoring my account, which is creepy, they would know I never carry a balance. These people are stealing my time, ergo life, along with literally hundreds of millions of other people every day, and it just keeps getting worse. This has to cost tens of billions in productivity every year. They are compromising my ability to run my business. Enough. I will no longer enable them. My business runs largely on legitimate email and texts. Legislature, please do something to help everyone in this country. Pass some badly needed and surely widely supported bipartisan legislation to end this harassment. Reader's note, the harassment he's referring to is spam telephone calls. End reader's note. Since I made that decision, I can now just smile at the phone when it rings. I called a business recently and had to press 1 to connect to someone. Easy, low cost, effective call screening. Can someone please make an app for that so I can install it on my phones? Thank you, by the way. Have you considered ending your automobile warranty? Extending your automobile warranty. And the final letter, Pat Merkin writes from Story City. I am a fourth generation Iowa farmer. I believe in supporting the biodiesel industry because using the products we grow here in Iowa supports farmers and our economy. The soybean-based biodiesel market adds value to every bushel of soybeans we farmers sell, and it lowers the cost of soybean meal for livestock farmers. Biodiesel is an excellent fuel for the consumer concerned about the environment, as it reduces greenhouse gas emissions by up to 86%. When we think of ways to reduce our carbon footprint, biodiesel is the answer available to us right now, with no change in infrastructure. I encourage others to champion the use of soy biodiesel because it makes good sense for cleaner air and supports nearly 4,000 jobs in the state of Iowa. And here's the Dennis the Menace comic for today. Dennis and his friend Tommy are sitting on the porch. They're eating a popsicle or a ice cream bar, something like that. And Margaret is walking down the sidewalk out in front of the house, and she's wearing a mask, you know, a COVID-19 type of mask. And Dennis looks at Tommy and he says, "What Margaret really needs is a zipper, not a mask." And here's the real life comic for today. Son and father are sitting on the couch. Dad looks like he's drinking a beer. It's a can anyway, maybe it's soda pop. They're watching television together on the couch, and this young son asks, "Dad, they keep talking about cold case. What is that?" And Dad says, "Well, that's when a bunch of detectives sit around and split some cold beers and talk about crimey stuff." Next, we have a story from the Associated Press. The dateline is Warsaw, Poland. Poland plans pensions for dogs and horses. They locate survivors in collapsed buildings. They track down fugitives. They foil drugs and explosive smugglers. And they help control rowdy crowds, all in exchange for food and lodging, and an occasional pat on the head. But when retirement time comes, state care ends for the dogs and the horses that serve in Poland's police, border guard, and fire service. They are given away with no safeguards for their future welfare. Following appeals from concerned service members, the Interior Ministry has proposed new legislation that would give these animals an official status and paid retirement to help cover the often costly care bills their new owners face. Interior Minister Maruszek Zamiński described the draft law as a moral obligation. which should get unanimous backing when presented in Parliament for approval later this year. More than one human life has been saved, more than one dangerous criminal caught, thanks to the animals in the service, he said in February. The new law would affect some 1,200 dogs and more than 60 horses currently in service. Each year, some 10% of the animals are retired, according to the Interior Ministry. Most of the dogs are German or Belgian shepherds. Pawel Krucino, handler of Warsaw Police sniffer dog Orbita, says, "Retired dogs almost always require expensive medical care to deal with complaints such as strained hind joints. The pension money will certainly be a great help, and it will make things easier," he said. The bill would confirm the unwritten rule that the animals' handlers have priority in keeping them before they are offered up for adoption. But more importantly, it would extend state responsibility for the animals into their retirement time and secure financial support for the owners. Salawir Walawaliak, who is 50 and a former policeman, caring for retired service dogs and horses at Poland's only dedicated shelter, which is named the Veterans Corner, says regular state payments would ease concern over bills that reach into thousands of zlotys, or dollars, monthly. The privately run farm-like shelter in Gryfatowo, west central Poland, houses 10 dogs and 5 retired police horses in a spacious paddock. The oldest horse there, Hypol, is in his late 20s and almost blind. Walawalak says he would have a slim chance of surviving at a regular stable. Walawalak says many service dogs end up chained to posts or being given unsuitable tasks, as people think they would make good guardians for farms or other properties, and this is not always the case. The dog may suddenly remember that it was trained to bite, and it will start biting. And when left alone at home, it may demolish the couch because it needs to have something in its mouth, Walawalak said. In Warsaw, Mounted Police Officer Dularzek Malawaski says he would have to pay the stabling fees for his 13-year-old black gelding, Rywal, if he were to keep him after retirement. A stable box near Warsaw could cost some 2,500 zlotys, or $650 a month. The average pre-tax monthly salary in Poland is some 5,500 zlotys, or $1,400 American. On patrol with Malowski was Sergeant Kartienka Zukenska, riding 13-year-old Romeo II, or Romex, who can identify Kuzinski by her voice. These animals have worked for the state, they have done their jobs well, and they should be entitled to health care and proper retirement on green pastures in the case of horses, Zoyinski said. And here's another Dennis the Menace comic today. Dennis is riding in the back seat of the car, driven by his dad. His mother is in the front seat, passenger seat. And Dennis talks to his dad and he says, "What good is taking the scenic route if you have to keep your eyes on the road?" And here's the real-life comic. Son is talking to his father, who's sitting at the kitchen table having a cup of coffee, and the son walks up and he says, "Dad, can you drive a golf ball 300 yards? And dad says, "In the car, I can." And here's the Dilbert comic for today. Dilbert, of course, works in an office. He has a boss that is kind of both mean as well as dumb. I don't know what other word to use for it. Anyway, the boss is talking to Dilbert on a Zoom-type call through his computer, and he says to Dilbert, "I've decided to reduce your pay because you no longer commute." And the boss continues, "When you pocket those savings, it is as if you are stealing from the company." And Dilbert says, "Actually, it isn't like that at all." And the boss says back, "Everyone in prison says they're innocent too." Our next story comes to us from the Des Moines Register. A Des Moines man in the U.S. Capitol riot is in plea bargaining talks. A Des Moines man charged with breaking into the United States Capitol and chasing a police officer during the January 6 riots is in talks with prosecutors to plead guilty to at least some charges, according to BuzzFeed. That according to BuzzFeed on Thursday. The discussions were revealed during a status conference hearing for Douglas Austin Jensen in United States District Court for the District of Columbia. Jensen's attorney, Christopher Davis, declined a Des Moines Register request for comment, and a U.S. Department of Justice spokesperson did not immediately return calls or respond to emails seeking comment. The report came as a federal judge signaled Thursday that plea agreements were forthcoming for some of the hundreds of accused in the government's far-reaching investigation into the riots. In a hearing involving three Missouri defendants charged with illegal entry and disorderly conduct, U.S. District Judge Dabney Frederick said she expected plea offers would be extended in the near future as part of the larger inquiry. Prosecutors acknowledged last week that they were pursuing a broad conspiracy involving a large number of participants. This week, the government asserted that a leader of the parliamentary group known as the Oath Keepers coordinated with members of at least two other extremist sects, the Proud Boys and the Three Percenters, before the Capitol attack. Jensen was among the crowd that marched from a rally with then-President Donald Trump to the Capitol and forced his way in. And that brings us to the conclusion of reading the Ames Tribune for this Monday, March 29th, 2021. Your reader today has been Dave Sauerman. Thank you for listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped.